The higher we climbed up the mountain, the more active the volcano became. Soon the air was filled with an acrid stench. So thick was the dust that I could barely see Eckenstein, even though he was only a few meters in front of me. Every few minutes the mountain would spit tiny fragments of red-hot rock into the atmosphere. These spilled down upon us, burning holes in our clothes. The heat was unbearable. I emerged from one ash cloud to find Oscar hopping from foot to foot. When I asked him what he was doing, he told me his boots were melting. We decided at that point that descent might be the better part of valor. The Confessions of Alistair Crowley. John Burns explores the mountaineering career of Alistair Crowley. Episode 2. From the volcanoes of Mexico to the snow-capped Himalayas. In this, the second of my podcasts about Alistair Crowley's career as a mountaineer, I'll be following some of his expeditions from Mexico and on into the Himalayas. In my first podcast, I talked about how Crowley found an interest in mountaineering as an escape, really, from the horrors, I think, of Victorian public schools, and how that interest developed into a passion which he pursued by climbing in the Alps. In this podcast, I'll be taking things further as Crowley developed, and we'll be following Crowley into his early climbing in the higher mountains of Mexico and then on into the greater ranges of the Himalayas. In the early years of the 20th century, Crowley cemented his relationship with his climbing partner, Oscar Eckenstein. Eckenstein was already an experienced Himalayan climber and sought to help Crowley to develop his climbing abilities on into higher altitudes. To this end, Eckenstein and Crowley decided to travel to Mexico, where they could climb some of the volcanic peaks of the region that would give Crowley a taste of high altitude climbing. Crowley preceded Eckenstein out to Mexico and spent some time waiting for his arrival in Mexico City. I think it's worth noting that even in the midst of his pursuit of his mountaineering passion, Crowley would continue to pursue his other passions, which involved obviously poetry, what one might describe, I suppose, as mysticism, and he also continued to pursue passion for erotic adventures. Even on his climbing expeditions, Crowley would take with him large volumes of poetry and would be writing poetry in his tent. I imagine that Crowley would have found Mexico to be an escape from what he would have found the moral straitjacket of Victorian England. And it's worth relating, I think, one of Crowley's anecdotes that I think that Lawrence Sutton relates in his very fine book, Do What Thou Wilt, about the life of Alistair Crowley. Whilst living in Mexico City and awaiting the arrival of Eckenstein, Crowley spent the afternoon with a local prostitute and was so inspired by her that he went on to write some poetry. But I'll take up Alistair's own words here. One afternoon in Mexico, I picked up a woman who attracted me by the insensible intensity of passion that blazed from her evil, inscrutable eyes and tortured her worn face into a whirlpool of seductive sin. The encounter apparently so inspired Crowley that he spent 67 hours, I think, composing what he described as a poetical and magical drama, which Crowley himself thought was the climax of his first period of poetry. I'll try and read just a few lines of that poetry to give you some flavour, I think, of the experience that Crowley related. Mine was by weariness of blood and brain, more bitter fruit of pain, sought in the darkness of a harlot's bed to make me as one dead, to lose the girders of the soul, and gain breathing and life for the intelligible. Find death, yet find it living. Deep as hell I plunge the soul. By all blind heaven unbound, the spirit freed, pierced through the maze profound, and knew itself an eagle for a dove. She must have been some lady, yeah? During this period in Mexico, Crowley and Eckenstein were already making plans for their attempts on K2. It's one of the interesting things that they planned in the Himalayas. Eckenstein would be controlling, if you like, the budget for the expedition, and so nothing could be bought without his express consent. But they also agreed that there would be no interference with the prejudices and beliefs of native persons who might be encountered, either as indigenous residents or hired as guides and porters. But more interestingly, when one considers Crowley's nature, there was also an agreement that there was to be nothing to do with women, if at all avoidable. Let's return to Mexico. So in March of April of that there, Crowley and Eckenstein completed a series of impressive assaults. Their first conquest, and I'm going to try and pronounce this, I'm not sure if I'll get it right, was the climbing of the beautiful peak of Itzcoatl in Mexico. They climbed that particular mountain from a variety of approaches. But they also climbed other peaks called Calimo, Popocatépetl, and some also active volcanoes, which I suppose gave rise to the quote that I made at the beginning of the program. During this period, they both claimed to have achieved particular records. I think mountaineers don't really keep records these days, other than of routes that have been climbed. But in those days, there seems to have been a record for, if you like, rate of ascent. And Crowley claimed to have climbed something like 4,000 feet in under an hour at 20,000 feet. If he did that, then that would be a phenomenal feat of endurance, given the altitude and speed he'd have had to climb. And I think what's also interesting about the way Crowley writes about his mountaineering is that he never once mentions the fact that he was actually quite a severe asthmatic. Obviously, climbing at high altitude induces breathing problems in just about everybody. So it must have been doubly difficult to have been suffering from asthma. He does talk on occasions about his health breaking down, but he never actually uses the word asthma at all, as far as I'm aware, in his writings. It gives an insight into his character, I think, that at times, we all need an excuse in mountaineering. We all can't do things. We all get exhausted. And we turn back sometimes. And it would have been very easy, I think, for Crowley to have leant, if you like, on the crutch of his asthma and said, my chest was bad or whatever. But never once does he do that. That's an interesting aspect, I think, of this complex and fascinating man. There are a couple of other incidents which are worthy of note, I think, from Crowley's Mexican climbing expedition. They returned from a climb one day to be greeted by, I suppose, some fairly serious-looking locals who very gently and very sadly broke to them the news that Queen Victoria had died. Of course, whereupon Crowley and Eckenstein whooped with delight and celebrated late into the night. Crowley, of course, was no fan of Queen Victoria, who he blamed for her, if you like, repressive attitude. He called her the German Hausfrau, I believe. On another occasion, a local reporter cast some doubts as to the validity of Eckenstein and Crowley's claims to have climbed so many mountains in such a short time. Crowley and Eckenstein then invited this reporter to come with them, just to show him what it was like to climb the mountains. Unfortunately for this young man, Crowley tied the reporter between himself and Eckenstein, and then they then set off up the mountain at what must have been quite a Herculean pace. Now, obviously, the reporter wasn't a mountaineer and was towed up to the top of the mountain. Unfortunately for him, Eckenstein and Crowley then turned round and went down the mountain probably twice as fast, terrifying the poor man out of his wits. Apparently, he never, ever wrote a disparaging word about them again. With the peaks of Mexico conquered, Crowley and Eckenstein turned their eyes to the Indian subcontinent, to the Himalayas, where the true giants of mountaineering dwelt. Before I talk about Crowley's expeditions to the highest mountains of the world, I think it's worth just considering for a moment, especially for non-mountaineers, what he was actually taking on at that time. These days, you can pay a guide, I guess, to take you up Everest if you have the bottle and the money and the breath. But in those days, I think you have to remember, in the early part of the 20th century, neither of the poles had been conquered, and none of the highest peaks on the world had actually been climbed. Our state of knowledge about Himalayan climbing was in a very early level, really. we didn't really understand the physiology of the human body, what actually happened to the human body at high altitude. There were no drugs that would counteract altitude sickness. The state of mountaineering equipment, which is today very high tech, was extremely low tech in Crowley's days, with clothing being basically Harris tweed. It's also the case that climbing techniques and climbing equipment was pretty primitive at that time. The crampons that modern climbers wore, which are the spikes you wear in your feet, are now highly advanced and have been evolved over years. But in Crowley's day, they were a very basic spike that indeed Ekenstein had actually designed himself. So in many ways, they were climbing to the edge of the known universe. No one had climbed that high. And they were at the very forefront of climbing expeditions at the time. Only Conway's expedition, as far as I'm aware, had actually been to high altitude. They had attained an altitude of some 24,000 feet. But that was on a much easier peak than K2 that Crowley was to tackle. So certainly he was climbing at the highest level and into undoubtedly extreme risk. In 1902, Crowley and Ekenstein journeyed to India, there to make their attempt on K2. It's probably worth remembering that K2 is, even today, considered to be perhaps a greater challenge than Everest. It's not quite as high, but technically more difficult and certainly much more remote. So in 1902, it was a formidable challenge to consider, to say the least. And in fact, K2 was only actually climbed in 1954. So it was only half a century later that the peak was actually conquered. Crowley arrived in India before Ekenstein and travelled extensively before meeting up with him. During that period, he went on hunting expeditions and also expanded his understanding of yoga, even before they set foot on the mountain. The expedition was hampered by conflicts that had arisen between Ekenstein and Sir Martin Conway, who was at that time the president of the British Alpine Club. In 1892, Ekenstein had been part of Conway's expedition to explore the Upper Ballatoro Glacier, which is adjacent to K2. Whatever happened, Conway accused Ekenstein of attempting to poison him, and Ekenstein returned to England without having made any significant contribution to the expedition. Conway subsequently climbed Pioneer Peak, which at over 22,000 feet was the highest recorded ascent at that time. Conway, I think, was subsequently knighted and certainly was the establishment figure, if you like, of British mountaineering. As you can imagine, of course, Crowley and Ekenstein were considerably opposed to Conway. And Conway, for his part, attempted to do what he could to sabotage the Ekenstein-Crowley expedition. On his arrival in India, Ekenstein was effectively arrested and forced to return to Rawalpindi. This was probably because Conway had prevailed upon Lord Curzon, who was the Viceroy of India, and obviously an immensely powerful man, to actually try to prevent Ekenstein and Crowley actually making it to the mountain at all. It took a lot of negotiation and some threats, I think, of releasing details to the police before Ekenstein could be released and the expedition could begin in earnest. The expedition then pressed on to the mountain. The only major quarrel taking place between Crowley and Ekenstein was largely because Ekenstein wanted the expedition to travel light, and of course Crowley had numerous bound volumes of books in his luggage that he claimed would keep him mentally stable for the ascent. So the weight he was carrying was obviously exceptionally high. Once on the mountain, they made rapid progress onto what is believed today called the Abruzzi Ridge. Here they began to encounter the extreme weather that bedevils the region. The entire expedition was bedeviled by extreme weather, which took its toll on the party. Here, let's take up Crowley's own words, where he talks about his battle with snow blindness and the extreme conditions that they encountered. The next day found me completely snowblind. The pain is not so much severe as irritating. The feeling of having red hot sand in the backs of one's eyes. One keeps blinking, but the idea of removing it, of course, it won't be removed. My condition was due entirely to pottering about the camp for a few minutes in the snowstorm, fixing my tent. From July the 2nd to the 6th, the campsite was swept with one continuous snowstorm. It was the worst weather I have ever experienced anywhere in the world. The weather worsened, and the expedition pressed on, despite the fact that they were all reaching exhaustion. And they had become prey to interpersonal arguments and rivalries, something which bedeviled Himalayan climbing ever since its inception. Here there arose an incident which has passed into legend regarding Crowley. And that is the abiding story that Crowley threatened a fellow climber who wanted to descend with a revolver. The truth is actually somewhat different. Crowley was in his tent, debilitated by the harsh weather and the long climb. He was weakened and had contracted malaria. Hallucinating, he pulled a revolver on a fellow climber, Charles Knowles, who he thought was attacking him. Knowles easily overpowered Crowley and took the revolver off him. But this has become a legend amongst mountaineers that Crowley carried a gun and refused to allow anyone to descend. It is, of course, far from the truth. What's interesting, however, is that he saw the need to actually have a weapon on a mountain like K2. Perhaps it's the case that the Victorian gentleman didn't consider himself dressed when he was abroad unless he was carrying a weapon. What he possibly intended to shoot at that altitude, I don't know. It is, of course, possible that since no one had ever climbed to those altitudes, Crowley may have imagined that there may have been ferocious animals, or that even, indeed, the legend of the Yeti might be true, and they might meet some seven-foot man who they might have to dispatch. I don't know, but for whatever reason, he was carrying a revolver. I'm not sure whether other expedition members carried a weapon. Possibly they did. But anyway, he certainly didn't threaten to one of his climbing partners who was trying to descend. Another incident occurred high on the mountain that I think gives a good indication of the breadth and depth of knowledge that Crowley possessed about mountains and indeed about physiology. At the time of their expedition, a debate was raging amongst mountaineers, essentially about the effects of acclimatization. It was widely held that the human body could acclimatize to any altitude, just given enough time and preparation. Crowley, on the other hand, held the view, which is held by modern mountaineers, that above 20,000 feet, the body begins to deteriorate quite rapidly. And actually, it is better to stay low, make a foray above 20,000 feet to try and achieve your objective, and return to lower levels as soon as possible. That way you can conserve your strength. But this did have a profound effect on how sufferers from altitude sickness were actually treated at the time. One of the climbers, who I think you pronounce as Profanel, was struck down by pulmonary edema. And this is basically fluid in the lungs. And has proved, I suppose, fatal to a great many high-altitude climbers. The treatment at the time would have been to have treated him for pneumonia, something which would have had no effect on this high-altitude condition. Crowley argued vehemently, however, that the man be taken down to lower altitudes where he could recover from the altitude-induced sickness. This was eventually done. And Crowley, by his really quite advanced knowledge of physiology at the time, clearly saved this man's life. As the weather deteriorated and quarrels generated amongst the team, slowly the expedition ground to a halt. Crowley, it's notable, had spent over 68 straight days living on the Ballataro Glacier. Now, one can only imagine the hardship that must have caused him. Extreme low temperatures, buffeted by snow and wind. Spending such a long time on the glacier was, I think, a record at the time, and certainly one which may never have been exceeded since. Eventually, the weather deteriorated to such a point that it was impossible to consider climbing the mountain at all, and so the party retreated in defeat. It's worth noting, however, that despite the failure of this expedition, it did represent a very serious attempt on a mountain that was not to be climbed for half a century later. The expedition had reached around 21,000 feet on a mountain that was previously unclimbed, and it was as such a notable achievement. In my next podcast, I'll be following Crowley as he attempts to climb perhaps an even more challenging mountain, that of Kanchenjunga, and we'll follow his adventures on that great Himalayan peak. Thank you for listening. I've been John Burns. I do hope you've enjoyed the podcast. And if you'd like to see me performing in this year's Edinburgh Fringe with my one-man play, Alistair Crowley, A Passion for Evil, you'll find me every day at the Sea Venues at 4:15. But do please check the Ed Fringe website for booking details.